Brother Jeff, please.
Good morning. I was going through the readings in 1 Kings and kind of wondering what I was going to say about 1, 2, 3, 4 bad kings that are mentioned. 5 if you include the one in the end of chapter 15. But one thing that kind of stood out to me is we have this run of bad kings in Israel, and they all seem to be kind of punctuated by the long reign of Asa. In each of the, and what I mean by that is, in chapter 15, verse 25, or no, not verse 25. Yes, verse 25. Nadab, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel in the second year of Asa. And then in verse 33, the third year of Asa, we have Baasha becoming king. And then in 16, verse 8, the 26th year of Asa, Elah became king. And then verse 15, and it goes on, Zimri in the 27th year, Omri in the 31st year. So, it's almost as if they're being measured against King Asa by the long years of his successful reign. And then we get onto Ahab's reign and the stories of Elijah. So we have all these evil kings. Why do we then spend so much time on Ahab? Well, because there were plenty of other bad kings, but Ahab seemed to go even further and turn the kingdom even from bad to worse. But we're not going to focus on Ahab. We're going to start with Baasha in 1533. So in the third year of Asa, he becomes king. And there are 23 years that he's reigning, because in the 26th year of Asa, Elah becomes king. So we have Baasha. Now there's war between Baasha and Asa. And if you just drop down to fifth verse, that's the wrong verse, 15:16. Yes, no, it's the right verse. 15:16, there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, throughout their reigns. And for a few more details on that conflict, we're just going to pull some more information out of 2 Chronicles 16, where we have the account of Asa's reign. Now we have a conflict that comes up in Asa's last years, in the 36th year of Asa's reign, in chapter 16 of 2 Chronicles, Asa relies on the king of Aram to solve his Baasha problem. In verse 1, we have Baasha becoming king, or sorry, not Baasha becoming king, Baasha, king of Israel, going up against Judah and fortifying Ramah. Then we come down to verse 6. And the king of Asa brought all the men of Judah and carried away from Ramah the stones and timber Baasha had been using. With them he built up Geba and Mizpah. Now, between this we have no coming to God and no asking for guidance. We have the king of Aram that's relied on to solve his problem. It was successful. He stopped Baasha's advance, and he stopped his work, and he stopped the fortification. But he didn't come to God. He didn't trust in God. We have this run of bad kings in Israel who weren't listening to God, and for the majority of Asa's reign, he was listening. But for this one point, he didn't listen. And so Hanani comes to him in verse 7. And it's a bit of a downhill slide from there, the end of Asa's reign. And in verse 7 it says, At that time Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you. And he hears from the prophet what he doesn't want to hear. And what does he do? He gets angry. He gets angry with the seer and even puts him in prison. In verse 10, and he was in a rage because of this, and he inflicted cruelties on some of the people at the time. Very unlike David's reaction with his sin with Bathsheba. And when Nathan the prophet came to him, he listened to God and submitted. And as a result of Asa's not listening, he has this problem with war that continues. Verse 9, you have done a foolish thing, and from now on you will be at war. And not only that, he is afflicted with a disease in his feet in verse 12. So it was all about listening. Asa listened until the end. Jeremiah 42 is another interesting account. When I read Jeremiah 42, I just couldn't remember ever having read it before. But I must have read it before. What goes on here? Well, back in chapter 40, we have Gedaliah. And Gedaliah was a ruler that had been installed by the Babylonians. And it seems that some people didn't like this situation, and they took it upon themselves to free Israel. Well, Gedaliah in the first, around verse 8 of chapter 40 is a little bit nervous about taking rulership, I think. We have in verse 9, Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, took an oath to reassure them and their men. Do not be afraid to serve the Babylonians, he said. Settle down in the land and serve the king of Babylon, and it will go well with you. Okay, so now we have some reassurance. We have probably someone who has listened to the prophecy, who has listened to Jeremiah, and obeyed and submitted to the Babylonians. So we have this advice here in verse 9. Do not be afraid to serve the Babylonians. Now, interesting, in verse 13, we have Johanan and his officers. They come to Gedaliah and they say that Ishmael is plotting to take your life. Gedaliah wants none of this. We don't know particularly why he didn't listen to Johanan, but Gedaliah must have respected or trusted or had some previous relation with Ishmael, and didn't believe that Ishmael would be capable of doing such a thing as taking his life. Johanan knew that Ishmael was hired by the king of the Ammonites. And he wanted to go out and kill Ishmael and his men before they had a chance to get to Gedaliah. So here we have Gedaliah in the end of chapter 40 saying to Johanan, don't do such a thing. No way. You're not going out to take on Ishmael, because what you're saying is completely wrong and untrue. He wasn't listening. In the first three verses of chapter 41, tells of Ishmael, and he was of royal blood. Maybe he held a grudge against these Babylonians and thought really that the throne should be his. But he kills Gedaliah and those with him, including the Babylonian soldiers. Then, to go even further, he really tricks the friends of Gedaliah into coming and joining with him to mourn over Gedaliah before they knew that he was murdered by Ishmael, gathers them all together, and murders them too. And then takes captives and hostages and makes a run for Ammon. Interestingly enough, we have in verse 9 this link to Asa. When Asa was fighting with Baasha, remember we mentioned that he had fortified one of the cities. And here we have in verse 9, now the cistern where he threw all the bodies, and this is Ishmael throwing all the dead bodies of the people that he had killed, along with Gedaliah, was one that King Asa had made as part of his defense against Baasha, king of Israel. And this is at Mizpah. A rather eventful place. But why are Johanan and the others now in chapter 41, verse 18, afraid of the Babylonians? So what's happened here is Ishmael's taken off toward Ammon. Johanan went with his men and cut him off and stopped him and rescued all the people that were with him. Now, Johanan had been with Gedaliah since the beginning. He'd been with him when he was reassuring them. And yet, he's afraid of the Babylonians. Are they also afraid of being implicated by association with Ishmael? I'm not sure. I'm not sure why they're afraid of the Babylonians at this point. But they are, and they're fleeing to Egypt. So when we find ourselves here in chapter 42, in today's reading, this is the point where Johanan and his men and the people with him decide that they're going to go and ask of God. They're going to listen to God and see what his advice is, what they should do. So they go to Jeremiah and ask for advice. Now, they seem to have best intentions going in. They seem to have the right attitude. Verse 6 of chapter 42, whatever is favorable, or whether it is favorable or unfavorable, we will obey the Lord our God to whom you are sending us, so that will go well with us, for we will obey the Lord our God. They would have known exactly how Judah had fallen to Babylon. They would have known how God's word had been fulfilled, how Judah would have been taken. So it appears that Johanan and the people with him are very wise, and that they've learned that God is in control. Whether good or bad, we will obey the voice of our God, of the Lord our God. So they seem to be ready and willing to come under the consequences that God has declared. And so they ask Jeremiah what they should do. Now, it struck me as interesting that there's 10 days between when they ask Jeremiah what to do and when Jeremiah comes back with the word of God. And that's verse 7. There's a 10-day interval between when they ask God and when God replies. God's answer comes in his time. And they would have had to have patience. When we ask God for things, we often try to rush them or expect immediate results. And the correct way, and often the hard way, is to have patience. How do we use the time that when we're waiting for God's response? Well, how had these men used this time? Had they been patient? Well, It doesn't seem like they were. It seems like they used this time to figure out what the best way of going about things was and make a decision that this was the way that God was going to answer them. They had already made the decision, and they had already come up with the best option. And they went as far as, in chapter 43, verse 2, to make up a reason why they shouldn't listen to Jeremiah. Azariah, son of Hoshea, and Johanan, son of Kareah, and all the arrogant men said to Jeremiah, "You are lying. The Lord our God has not sent you to say you must go to Egypt to settle there." But verse 3, "Baruch, son of Neriah, is inciting you against us to hand us over to the Babylonians so they can kill us or carry us into exile into Babylonian." Despite the warnings, as in verse 4, they disobeyed. In verse 4, it says, "Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the commanders of the forces and all the people did not obey the voice of the Lord to remain in Judah." What was the consequence? Well, verse 16, they would fear the sword. They would be always on the run. They would be subject to famine and pestilence. And they would always be afraid. And in Egypt, they would die. It wasn't just warnings, though. It was encouragement as well. When we have in verse 11, encouragement made to Johanan, "If you would choose what God has presented to you." Verse 11 says, "Do not fear the king of Babylon, whom you are afraid. Do not fear him, declares the Lord, for I am with you to save you and to deliver you from his hand. I will grant you mercy that he may have mercy on you and let you remain in your own land." Now that strikes me as awfully similar to in chapter 40 when Gedaliah was ruler of the assurance of "Do not be afraid to serve the Babylonians. Settle down in the land and serve the king of Babylon and it will go well with you." They seem to have it figured out then. And yet, here we are in chapter 42 and into 43 where they decide, no, the better decision is to go to Egypt. Have we already made up our minds what God's answer should be? Have we already decided how things should be? Well, coming into Jesus' time, the Pharisees and Sadducees certainly had. They had already made up their minds how things should be. They had their life well established, and the Messiah coming along and demanding the people's attention was kind of messing up their situation in life. They weren't too happy about this. The people, in fact, hailed Jesus as some kind of a prophet, and very few, although there were some, actually even recognized him as Messiah. Well, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the rulers certainly couldn't have this going on because they were the true rulers. It's interesting that the Sadducees denied resurrection. And yet in their own law, and in 1 Kings chapter 17, we have this account of the widow at Zarephath. What had Elijah done? Now, I ask myself, what would the Sadducees, how would they explain what happened in 1 Kings 17 with the widow of Zarephath? In verse 17, the widow's son dies. His illness was so severe, it says, that there was no breath left in him. And so we have, in verse 18, she appeals to Elijah. and says, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" And so we have Elijah in verses 20 to 22 crying to God and asking him to help and to raise the son to life again. And in verse 22, the life of the child came into him and he was revived. Elijah raised the widow's son. And this isn't the only time that resurrection comes up in the Old Testament. A bit further on in 2 Kings 4, we have Elisha. And this time with the Shunammite woman. And in verse 19, well, first what happens is of course, the Shunammite woman wants a son, wants a child, and she's blessed with a child, as Elijah had told her. And then in verse 18, the child grew. And then he's going out to the field to meet his father. And he says, my head in verse 19. And so his father got a servant to carry him into his mother. And verse 20, after the servant had lifted him up and carried him to his mother, the boy sat on her lap until noon and then he died. Verse 32, we have Elisha coming into the house, and he saw the child lying dead on his bed. This boy was dead. Yet he went in and shut the door and prayed to God. He got up again and walked back and forth in the house, verse 35, and went up and stretched himself upon him, and the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. I can't imagine the feeling of the Shunammite woman after receiving her son back to life. And yet, the Sadducees weren't listening. They had made up their minds about resurrection, not to mention Jesus himself. They had made up their minds that, no, the Messiah doesn't belong here right now. And yet, Jesus, in Luke 7, raises a widow's only son. In Luke 7, a man is being carried out dead. And everyone is mourning, and Jesus feels compassion on the man, or on the woman, rather. The man is dead. And I'm wondering if perhaps this is why many of the people labeled Jesus as Elijah, raised to life. If you remember when Christ was asking Peter, well, who do people say that I am? And some say Elijah and some say one of the prophets. In verse 16, of Luke 7. No. Verse 16 of Luke 7. 17. That's what. Verse 16 of Luke 7. We see that they were filled with awe and praised God. A great prophet has appeared among us, and God has come to help his people. What an amazing thing. A man was raised from the dead. That is not something you see. He raised Jairus' daughter from the dead, and that's in Mark 5 and Luke 8. He raised Lazarus from the dead in John 11. The Sadducees must not have understood who God was. Out of their own law, in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 39, it says, "See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. There is none that can deliver out of my hand." God breathed life into Adam and Eve. Could he not take it and give it back? Yet the Sadducees weren't listening, and they turned their backs on the inconvenient parts for them. In John 10, we have Jesus speaking about shepherding his flock. In verse 11, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. What does Jesus have to say about his life? In verse 17, for this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This charge or command I have received from my Father. Why is this authority or charge or command given? What does this really mean? That he's given authority. Well, what is Jesus trying to get across? Just that he can die and he can live again on a whim? That's not it at all. There's much more to that. There's a charge. This command that he's received is a burden or a task. A task to maintain this authority and have it all work is to remain sinless. And he did that perfectly. In other words, Jesus heard God. He heard everything perfectly. And he didn't balk. In his 33 years, he never once denied God's answer. He never once turned away and said, no, that doesn't suit me. That can't be right. He never once said, well, it must be something else, or I found a better way. But he listened, and he heard, and he followed. And that's what we remind ourselves of today. Do we hear as well when God speaks to us? Do we really listen when words such as 1 Corinthians 6:12 are spoken? All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. They're hard words to put into practice. Philippians 2, verse 14, do all things without murmuring and disputings, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may rejoice in the day of Christ that I have not run in vain, neither labored in vain. With this same hope that Paul describes, let us also run with patience. At God's pace and not at our own pace, listening to him, having also heard that God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by his power.